There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Because there came a point where, even though I knew that the boys were gone, it was a long time before I went, they're gone but not coming back. Mm. And there's a difference.
Welcome to Grief Encounters with me, Sasha Hamrogue.
And I'm Venetia Quick. We're a weekly podcast that looks at an issue that affects us all and yet remains so difficult to talk about.
We'll be chatting to guests from all walks of life on the subject of death and all that comes with it.
Our main aim is to motivate, comfort, and create a modern space for people to share their own experiences.
Could you think of someone that could benefit in listening? Tell them about Grief Encounters, out every single Tuesday.
On today's episode, we're meeting Kathleen Chayda. She's going to be talking to us about the unthinkable tragedy that she suffered in July 2013. In the interview, she's going to speak to us about keeping memories alive in the worst possible circumstances.
Yeah, so this interview was obviously, it was an honor to be able to speak to her because she's a remarkable person who has suffered really, I think all of us would probably consider the worst possible thing that could happen.
Just perhaps to remind people that in July 2013, 5 years ago, Kathleen's two sons were strangled by their father and put in the boot of the car, which he then proceeded to try and attempt to take his own life by crashing into the wall. Now, he, as we know, walked away from the accident. And while he is serving life in prison, Kathleen is also serving a different sort of life in prison, if you want, because not only did she lose her two boys, she lost her husband. She lost everything that was important to her.
And I think that what's so interesting is the way that she's able to even manage to talk about it to us. There's so much to take away from it. How she keeps the boys' memories alive is so beautiful and moving. And I think she loved talking about them, which I found was such a great thing to be able to learn a little bit about them. And oftentimes when people are grieving, all they want to do is maybe talk a little bit about the person or the people that they lost.
For other people to listen.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, it's a very, very open, honest interview. Kathleen was incredibly open with us, and I think a lot of people, if you talk to people about losing perhaps kids, and so many people have, that people who haven't but who are parents go, oh, I don't know what I do, I couldn't get up in the morning. But listening to Kathleen describe how she does get up in the morning and how she does go to work and how she does do the shopping or do her day-to-day life, and especially now coming up to Christmas, how she deals with, for so many people, what is a horrendous time of the year, and perhaps even more so if you've lost your kids. So Kathleen, would you like to take us back to what happened in July 2013.
I lost my sons Owen and Rory. They were killed by their dad on the 29th of July. I had found out about 10 days beforehand that he had embezzled money from our local community centre. So life had been a bit odd, if you like, for the previous 10 days, but I thought we were getting back on track, and I thought we were, you know, sort of, he'd acknowledged it. He was doing something about it. So on the Sunday, the 28th, when he said he was going to take the boys away for the afternoon and just give me a bit of time out, I didn't really think an awful lot of it. It wouldn't have been an unusual thing to have happened at all. So they We're supposed to be going bowling that evening. I'd gone out for a walk with a friend, come home, sat down watching telly, cup of tea. And by about 10 o'clock, I started to wonder. And then I phoned him and discovered he'd left his phone behind. Again, not too unusual. He had a new phone, so it was just one of those things. But then within an hour, I started to worry and wonder. My brother drove me into Carlo to see where they were supposed to be going. No sign of the car. And I remember vividly coming back up the road towards my house going, please let his car be there. Please let his car be there.
I read somewhere that your first concern was actually for your husband.
For him.
That's where you were, your mind was at that time.
Because of what had happened, I suppose thought, well, could he do something to himself? And my mantra all through the almost the 24 hours where they were missing was, they'll be okay. He'll be okay. He's got the boys with him. He'll be okay because he's got the boys with him. And it would never, ever have occurred to me that he would hurt the boys. I thought they'll be wondering what's going on, what has happened. They'll be scared when we get them back. And for that reason, I'd asked his brother, who was up in the north, to actually come down, because I said, okay, this is happening. We had already involved the Gardaí by about midnight, just after midnight. And I had phoned his brother up in the north to see if they'd maybe gone up there, and they hadn't. But I remember thinking, okay, everybody's going to be angry with Sanj now. So he's going to need somebody that's going to kind of just sweep him away because I was angry. Yeah, because I was angry with him and I wasn't going to want to see him. I knew even at that stage I'd need to keep a little bit of a lid on it for the boys' sake, because they'll have been wondering what was going on. So that was kind of throughout the night. But again, even that night, I thought, okay, he's not gone up to Kesh, so maybe he's gone back to his mum over in London, and maybe he's gone on the ferry. So I assumed that that was what it was.
And all this time, you assumed the boys were with him.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I knew they would be, because, I knew they'd be okay with him, that they'd feel, you know, he's their dad, they loved him, he loved them. He was never anybody that would have been abusive or would have caused any issues, or, you know, it would have been normal for them to have been with them. They'd have wondered why they were away overnight. I think that anyway. But other than that, I would have said there wasn't anything that they would have necessarily been concerned about at that stage. But even throughout that whole night and the next day, it was okay. He's going to be scared. He's going to be wondering. He's going to wonder, what can he do? Where can he go? Where can he turn? He's panicked. He's panicked because he's been found out. He's panicked because he's afraid I'm going to kick him out or whatever. But I always felt at that time that the worst that the boys would have been scared. Him actually hurting them in any way, until it was confirmed, was not something I could have ever have imagined.
When did the news come through to you that what had happened? Because he crashed the car with the kids in the boot.
So throughout that morning, I suppose various things were happening. Guards were coming and going, and I had to give a statement. And it was, in hindsight now, when I think about it, we'd gone into the sunroom, which is just off the sitting room. It was a quiet little spot. And I was sat with one of the detectives, and I had my phone with me because there would have been various phone calls coming through. When he sat down and he started off with, so, Kathleen, you were born here in Ballinkillen. And I was like, oh my, how much of my life do you actually need to know? And it literally was from then all the way through to meeting Sanj and sort of our relationship, things like that. And that continued for, I have no idea sort of the time scale on it. But the next thing, the phone rang and it was a number that I didn't recognize. So I answered it again. Lots of numbers were coming through, the guards, various, etc. I answered it and it was Sanj on the other end of the line. And it was like, and you go into this strange phase. I've seen all the detective things on television where you go, you keep him talking. You know you keep them tongue. So I'd made eye contact with the detective that was with me, and it was like, okay, I needed to keep him talking here now. Where are you? What's happened? Where are the boys? And the first thing Sanj said to me was, there's been a crash. And he said, the boys are dead in the back, were the words. So he's the one that actually told me himself. And I dropped the phone at that stage, or handed it straight over to the detective. It's all a bit hazy, but I remember walking out, and everybody had realized that, because it's glass doors into the sitting room, and sort of anybody that was there, my parents and that, realized that something's going on. And so they were watching what was inside, and the next thing they see me just falling apart. So I walked back out into the sitting room, and I remember sitting down, and I have no idea the time frame on this, but I remember sitting there staring, looking at the detective going, it can't be true. It can't be true. He's okay. So the boys are probably dazed, or they're, you know, something, they're unconscious, whatever. Mm. But if he's okay and he was driving, they must be okay. Mm. And God love that poor detective, because I still remember staring at him and everything. He now held my entire life in those moments, because he was the one that was going to tell me that my boys were okay and I just needed to get in a car and go to them.
Mm. But that's
or not. And it was a not. And he had to go off. He had to confirm, you know. And I mean, he's talking to people, you know, even getting official confirmation at that stage. And I know details now, I didn't at the time. But even for him to get those that confirmation. And in fairness to the car, it felt like forever, but it was probably quite fast, and they were able to tell me. I remember him confirming it, and then I just lost it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no words. No. There's no words at that stage, because the entire life is pulled out of you at that point, and people came around and they were trying to hold me, and I didn't want to be held, and I didn't want anybody there, and I wanted everybody there. And
you just don't know what you want.
You just don't know what you want. I knew exactly what I wanted, but I wanted but I also, even in those moments, knew that that wasn't gonna be. So
Can you tell us about the boys? You know, I've seen their pictures, and I know it's probably very difficult to talk about, but I would love just to know a little bit about
the boys.
Them.
Oh, no, it's not difficult. You give me an opportunity to talk about Owen and Marie, and I will take it. Well, at the time, they were 5 and 10. Owen is the oldest. Owen was 10, and Marie 5. And they were very close as brothers, actually. I always said the fact that we had those sort of 5 years between them was quite nice. Because even though they weren't close in age, they were very, very close as brothers. And they were both incredibly sporty. GAA was their big passion. Owen hurling. Rory wasn't quite sure yet. He was a bit iffy as to whether football might be the one for him. But certainly hurling at that stage was okay too. I mean, we used to joke that they would literally watch two flies going up a wall, as, you know, it had been the Olympics. The Olympics had been on, and Rory had sussed out how to go to teletext, and I mean, I caught him watching table tennis one of the days, anything. So they were just bright and happy and very easygoing. They were good kids, normal. They try your patience, as any child will do. But they actually had, they were kind. Owen in particular would have had a very gentle way about him, which, you know, when it's described to you as a mum, you're going to, you know, the pride does come out. And his teachers would have talked about how they knew where to put him sitting or who to put him sitting next. So he had a great ability to draw out a quiet child out of themselves and to calm a child that was maybe a little bit more boisterous, which I always thought at 9 and 10 to have that was quite
remarkable,
incredible.
Yeah.
So to, you know, and these would have been stories that I've heard before I lost them. So I know they were true. So at parent teacher meetings, and that, you know, you go in as a parent to a parent teacher meeting, you know, going, okay, what's going on? But the only thing I was ever told negatively was that they were never going to be on the stage. So they didn't have a note between them. That's it. So they couldn't sing. But other than that, they were very well rounded. Rory kind of ruled the roost because I always thought he had confidence because he had his big brother there. Mm-hmm. You know, so he literally grew up on the sidelines of the pitch watching Owen play. And so when it came to his turn, it was very easy for him. And I remember him, his first day in school, walking in, and one of the older kids sort of came across and high-fived him. And I remember thinking, you'll be all right.
Yeah.
You'll be okay, because, you know, they knew him so well. And it was almost like they bypassed Owen to get to Rory at times. And I remember Owen coming home one of the days going, they all want him to sign their books or their bags, Mammy. And I'm like, ah, that's lovely. He said, yeah. So he got little pieces of paper and got Rory to sign them. And he was going out, handing out his
autograph.
But he was proud about it.
Yeah.
It was, which was lovely, because there wasn't any jealousy or any, you know, he actually was quite proud that Rory had this. So they were, now, as I say, they would try your patience at times too, you know, and they did have that ability, but they were easygoing kids and had a great sense of fairness about themselves. And we used to try and go out, we'll say, for lunch nearly every week, and they used to take it in turns to choose, which, you know, so if it happened to not be a Sunday, because Rory's favourite was the white chicken in the local Indian in Carlow, which was basically chicken korma, but white chicken. And if it happened to not be to be his turn, but that the white chicken wasn't going to be on the menu, then he'd give it to Owen to take a turn and come back at it. So that was the way they were.
Little memories like that, just as you describe them, which are, as kids, describe just things that we all know the proper name of. How difficult is that for you now when you see something like chicken korma on a menu? It must give you a dart, or you see, I don't know, something really simple that they liked or they didn't like, and you went...
Mm. And it does. It's hard to say whether it's difficult or not. Because it happens. And it's funny, people talk about this time of the year, coming up to Christmas or coming up to their birthdays or things like that. And
it's all the time.
You're prepared for that, actually. You are preparing yourself. You're actually thinking, okay, this is going to be hard, so I'm going to have to do this or that or the other. It's the unexpected times. It's the times that I'm walking down the street and I see somebody that looks like them, or I see two brothers that look like they'd be about the same age, or driving up the street in Ballinkillen when I know the school is opening tomorrow, but I've driven up and there's all those teachers' cars there and I hadn't really anticipated or expected that. And you're suddenly going, okay, this would be how it would be. Or, you know, one of Owen's friends got Player of the Year this weekend for Ballinkillen for hurling. And I know how Owen would have been with Eric and would have enjoyed celebrating that with him. So it's those moments. And it's I didn't know that the awards were happening as such this weekend. I'd have no reason to. It wasn't, you know, just because I wasn't around. And yet when you hear about it afterwards, you're delighted for the kids, but actually going, they should have been there. And it's those little things. So it's the things that you can't anticipate that are worse.
It's being caught off guard.
Completely.
I think when it comes to grief, the thing that's interesting is that the relationship doesn't end. No. And I think a lot of people think that when maybe the person dies, that it's over, but it actually goes on.
It does.
You know, I'm sure that's been the case for you. How do you feel you best honour the boys? How do you keep that relationship kind of going?
Loads of ways in a way. I suppose for me, a lot of it is faith. I do have a strong faith. It doesn't mean I go to Mass every Sunday, but I do have a strong faith. So for me, they're not gone as such. They're very much in the house with me. There is a sense of them being there. I'll chat to them. I have their teddy bears beside me in bed. And it's funny, last night, for the first time in a long time, I held them while I was going to sleep because I was finding it hard to go to sleep. And that happens sort of just out of the blue. The light in Owen's room comes on a regular basis. Is it them? Is it the electrics in the house? Mm. I don't really care what it is.
Signs.
It's the signs. Yeah. And I always think if you go looking for the big signs or something obvious, you'll miss all of these little things. So the little things are what help. And even when walking out this morning, which has never happened before, the light came on. So I had to go back up the stairs to turn it off. And you stop in the doorway and you have a little word and you just have a chat with them. And it's that sort of thing. So the relationship is still there. It's a little bit odd from the perspective of, on some sort of supernatural level, they know more than me now. Mm. They're wiser than I am. So that's very odd as a mother, because you should be wiser than your child at this stage. So what do they know, and what do they do, and where are they in me? And that relationship changes. You know, about 2 years ago, so it would have been 3 years after losing them, that shifted. And it's hard to actually put it into words and say exactly, but there was a shift of some kind, where it was almost like I let them go, but in letting them go, they're with me in a different way. Mm. And I'm in the early days of that feeling and that sense, it was like trying to hold on, trying to go, no, I need to heed them, I need to feel them, I need to know that they're there. And you're kind of getting tense and you're squeezing, and but actually then when you relax and you go, you know what? They're still there. They're still with me. They're in a good space. They're in a good place. They're happy. In whatever that is, and they're together. Mm. But I'll never lose them. I'll always have them beside me.
If you're looking for a safe haven to express how you feel, share articles, photos, and memories of your loved ones, join the Grief Encounters Facebook group, a place for support, compassion, and empathy for those grieving.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Can I just ask you how you got to that point? Because I know you've talked about trauma counselling as opposed to grief counselling. And there'll be a lot of people listening to you now going, who may have been recently bereaved, who are going, how the hell did she get to this point where she can sit down and talk about it so calmly, apparently, and almost in some sense, almost forgivingly, or I don't know what the word is, but you know what I'm saying. Yeah. Just in, you can sit here and you can talk about the boys.
The boys.
And how did you get to that point? What could you say to people who are just can never see themselves getting to that point where?
I start off because I'm often asked, how do you? And I'm very conscious that I make it look easy when I'm talking. And it's not. Mm. So don't be fooled by that. I can talk now. I live with this every day. So I've had 5 years of this conversation, be it in person or in my head. So that gets you to a point where you can talk about it almost like there's no emotion. And part of that is because you kind of have to. You can't have that deep, heavy emotion every time. So I go back to the start, if you like, for me, which is I came from a very grounded family. And in the circumstances, I consider myself very lucky. So I have a good family, extended family and friends support network. And that kind of started me off. I'm kind of quite a practical person. So it's like, okay, we're here. What now? What do I have to do now to get myself to the next point? Mm. So there's an element of that. But most of all, I met the right counsellor or psychologist. And Tim had, he's retired now as it happens, but he had a history of trauma counselling. And that's what I was having in the beginning. I wasn't having grief counselling. Grief counselling, you know, all the theory behind it says you've got to wait 6 months or a year or a certain point. But within 5 weeks, I had started seeing him, and I was seeing him 3 times a week to begin with, on the recommendation of a friend who is a psychotherapist herself. And that, again, as I say, I was very, very lucky that I met the right person. So he was able to just let me talk as much or as little as I needed to and let me bring every emotion out, because in the early days, it was all about Sanj. Mm. And it was about Sanj because it was easier to actually think about him and manage him in my mind than it was to acknowledge the boys were gone. So although on a logical level, I knew they were gone, and every level, I knew they were gone. It wasn't that I didn't accept it. It was that it just didn't feel it. It didn't feel like they were gone. It didn't feel like they weren't going to walk in the door at any moment. So there's almost little boxes in your mind, and you put certain things into the boxes and you can take them out and put them back and take them out, put them back. But that let me, I suppose it allowed me to realize this was normal. This was okay to manage it this way. It was okay to not have to, you know, sort of go through grief counselling until I was ready to do it. Because there came a point where even though I knew that the boys were gone, it was a long time before I went, they're gone but not coming back. Mm. And there's a difference.
And there it can be hard to go to grief counselling when you haven't accepted the fact that you've experienced a loss. Yeah, God, I had never thought of that, but that's such a valid point. Yeah,
and so you have to actually give yourself the time. Now, it could have been different if I hadn't met him when I did. I don't know where I'd be, because family and friends are fantastic, and you need the support. But actually, they're going through their own grief at the same time, and loss, and they're trying to hold you, and they're trying to support you, and they're trying to make things better for you, you know, and they can't, and they're not trained. So, with Tim, although after 5 years I have a very good relationship with him, it wasn't a personal relationship to begin with, and that allowed me to sit and just talk. There was no judgment. It didn't matter what I talked about. And the complexity of it was actually down to the fact that I also lost my husband and my marriage. So, but I couldn't grieve him. I didn't want to grieve him apart from anything else, but I couldn't grieve him. I couldn't grieve that loss because he was still there. and he was responsible for everything. So it became very complicated even in my head, because I had loved him up until that point. Yeah. So it wasn't a relationship that had had sort of a gradual kind of downhill spiral. It had been a good relationship up until 10 days before. Mm. And suddenly, and I still hadn't even at that point processed that. Yeah. So you've got that loss as well. Mm. And the one person that you wanted beside you going through all of this was him.
He was responsible, yeah.
And yet he was responsible for it. He was the cause of it. And things like in the early days, he was in the Central Mental Hospital, and even down to packing a bag for him, which I did after the funeral, because that's what you do. Mm. That's what, as a wife, that's what you do. I was involved in some of the assessments. While I didn't see Sanj himself, I was involved in some of the assessments that were going on up there. And they were very good to me in the Central Mental Hospital, in fairness. But I remember the first time that I went up there bringing shampoo, socks, boxer shorts, books, because that's what you do for your husband in hospital. So, you know, when you see all these things in the media and that about, you know, I suppose families of victims maybe not reacting as people would expect them to react, it's because you can't.
But there's no template for how somebody should react. Everyone reacts differently.
There is no right or wrong. And that's one of the things I talk about with grief. There isn't a right or wrong to it. It's how do you negotiate it yourself? Mm. What is right for you? What works for you? Because there's a lot of presumptions. And I actually think that even now, people would accept me sat in a corner, sort of not communicating almost more than seeing me out and about and actually engaged with life.
Do you think there's sort of an attitude perhaps that, oh, look, she's out, she's having a glass of wine, she's grand, or she's doing tremendously, she's getting through it.
Yeah.
But then you go home and you close the front door and you crumble and you curl up into a ball, and that's how you really are.
And that's
and
how
they don't see that.
And they don't see that. You know, and while, I mean, there's a part of me that, and that's where when I say I can make it look easy, that's not fair on other people either to a certain extent. So, you know, you it isn't easy. And exactly as you've described, you know, you do walk in, and I have those couch days. Not as often as I used to, but they're the days where you can go in and you literally go from one TV program to another and go, I just don't want to move. And suddenly 2.5 hours later, you're still sat on the couch going, where's that time gone? Sometimes there's tears, sometimes there's not. But sometimes it's just, I want the world to go away and leave me alone. And then you put, and it is a game face, you put a face on and you go out. And sometimes that game face is real. Sometimes I often say I can still be happy. I haven't changed. Me, Kathleen, is still here. My life, the circumstances, all of that has changed. It is not the life that I want. It's not the life that I had. It's not the life that I should be living. But it is what it is now. And I have to, on some level, make something of it. And nobody else can do that for me. I have to do this. I made a decision very early on not to be bitter and not to be angry, because in a way that gave Sanj too much power. And it also meant that I couldn't have the relationship that I consider I now have with Owen and Rory if I was going to let bitterness and anger be everything. Because, you know, I still have friends and family. I have nieces and nephews, friends, children. And I think children in particular, I always say my nieces and nephews are what bring me joy now. And I think if I was angry, if that anger was inside of me and coming out all the time, they'd know instinctively and they'd just avoid you. It's not that they'd do anything, they just avoid you. Whereas I get the hugs and the kisses and the I love yous, and it means the world, you know. It really, really does. That's what you need. And that hasn't changed. They meant the world to me alongside Owen and Rory, and they still do.
Just want to ask you finally, you've channeled a lot of your energy and perhaps your grief into the SAVE campaign. Yeah. And you see this a bit when somebody dies tragically or early on, that people will find or create something to make life better for other people, which is exactly what you've done with the SAVE campaign. Yeah. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I suppose it started off, and you're absolutely right. And I think if you look at every children's charity in particular, they've inevitably come out of some tragedy somewhere. And for me, it wasn't that I wanted to start a charity. So I've spoken to a number of people, actually even in the Carlow-Kilkenny area, who have lost family members to homicide. And while the circumstances might be different in that it was maybe a partner, so not necessarily a family member or somebody as close to them as Sanjit was to me, that actually carried out the homicide. But we're looking at it, and when we came together, we realised that actually there's a lot that's not fair in the judicial system here in Ireland. And you look at it and you see it all the time now. And it was the realization that for me, Sanjit is entitled to apply for parole after 7 years. Okay, so that's a year and a half away. For taking the lives of his two sons, of my sons.
And taking your life.
And taking everything from me. And that he could walk away. Now, I know it's unlikely that he will get parole, but he's still entitled to apply. And he's still entitled to apply 2 years after that, and a year after that, and a year after that, etc. And I know that's changing. It's going to increase to 12 years. But even that's not quite good enough. What I would like to see, and what the group would like to see, is what we call minimum tariffs. They happen in the UK, in Australia, in various other countries. Because that gives the victims and the families of victims something more definite. So if Sanj had been given his two life sentences, which were running concurrently, which I have an issue with as well, but if I knew that he was going to spend a minimum of 20 years in prison, I could actually go, right, I've got the next 20 years of my life. I don't have to think about him. I don't have to worry about it. It's just, it'll come back then. But you know what? In 20 years time, I'll be in a different space. It would have been so much easier. Whereas, you know, suddenly we're 5.5 years in and only another year and a half before he has the opportunity. And I have to build myself up to that because I don't know whether he will or he won't. So I can't let it be that it'll come out of the blue. So I have to build up to it. I have to get myself prepared. I have to prepare another statement as to why he shouldn't be entitled. So that's really, and as simple as that concept is, you know, minimum tariffs, it isn't an easy thing in this country from a judicial perspective. So we're looking at other things as well. We're looking at advocacy. Not so much that we're becoming a support group. We will support anybody, but we want change. So this is about advocacy, not necessarily a support group like Support After Homicide or ADVIC. So we really want change. And I think there's an appetite for it now. So if we can look at this, looking at something called domestic homicide reviews, which happen in the UK, which give you a lot more information, it isn't going to change anything for me or for any of the members of the group. But we all recognise that there is a need to be open about this, so to be open about homicide itself and murder and not be afraid to talk about it and to accept that it happens in the most normal and ordinary of families. That it's not always just a headline, you know. So we're hoping, and in fairness, we have got support through all of the various political parties at this point. We've talked to them all. It's going to be a long, slow process, as anything is in any country. I won't say just Ireland, but trying to make any changes to laws are always going to be difficult. But we're in this for the long haul. As I say, we know it won't change anything for us, but we're hoping that further down the line on the next, you know, case or a similar case, which unfortunately, no matter how much we want to stop it, we know it's going to happen. We're hoping that we can make a difference with that.
Okay, well, Cathy, thank you. Very much indeed. And of course, if you want to find out more about the SAVE campaign, you can go to facebook.com/SAVE.